Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Pulse, where we talk to digital health experts, influencers, and entrepreneurs from all over the world, disrupting healthcare one conversation at a time. I'm your host, Dr. Maya Dafan, and today I'm super excited to be talking to our guest today. But just before that, a quick reminder to like our LinkedIn page, subscribe to our YouTube channel. We're also on 6 different podcast channels, including Spotify and Google Podcast. So tune in over there if you'd like. So today we have with us Dr. Khurram Sadiq. He is a neurodevelopmental psychiatrist, was included in the Leading Physicians of the World 2017 edition. He's a social media, gaming, and mental health expert and 4 times TEDx speaker. Thank you so much, Dr. Khurram, for taking out the time, and welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Dr. Maya, for inviting me here. It's my honor.
All right. So you're a practicing psychiatrist, you do TED Talks, and you also have a very niche area of special interest, which is social media, gaming, and mental health. So just tell me a little bit about how you ventured out into all these different domains.
All right. Okay. I'll start from the very start. And this is a story where I tell a lot of people. And I remember when I was in grade 7, like I was an average student. I was not extraordinary. I had my spurts, but then it would develop into troughs and plateaus. And one day my father, like he was a perfectionist. So he was driving, and I come from a Pathan background. So imagine a Pathan father talking to you, grade 7, we talk about 1980s. And he told me, he said that, I don't know what to do with you. You are so consistently inconsistent. And I kept quiet for a bit, and I said, but this is a consistency, isn't it?
Yeah.
He looked at me, he gazed at me, and he kept quiet. And the reason he said that I'm consistently inconsistent was because I was into too many activities at the time. So I would get myself enrolled in singing, math competition, quiz competition, apart from that, because I found that doing something on its own, like just concentrating on academia, was such a boring thing to do. You have to branch out. And that I gathered from a very early age, like around when I was 10 or 11, that I have to be doing something all the time in order to have my interest or to keep my focus on academics. I need to have something extracurricular. So I was crap at singing. I was crap at doing math. I was good at quiz competition. I won some, I lost some. But good thing I noticed was my public speaking. My public speaking was good. And despite of being on having an introverted preference, I still like that because I wanted people to share my ideas, to look into that. And not many people know that I stutter. I used to stutter quite a lot, quite massively.
Interesting.
It has improved. It has improved massively because what I did was I put in pauses in order to get my message across. At that time, not realizing that it's actually one of the rules of public speaking to have pauses in the right places. And that's what I used to do. So from there, it developed. I went into debates at different level. And when I came to this country, and I'm in UK, that was 2003. And I remember I had not used PowerPoint. So I asked one of my Indian friends to come and help me out. Mm-hmm. And my idea was to put everything on a PowerPoint and just narrate it. So I did my presentation, and my consultant was furious. He said, "Are you here to hypnotize us? Because half of the audience is asleep." And then I reflected on it. And then I started changing the way I do things. I started to have narratives. I used to have storylines. And it built up from there, slowly and gradually, from local level to a regional level. And it was not till 2012 when I actually went into training for my higher training in general adult psychiatry that I liked to go onto the podium. So it became more regional. It became more national. And in 2012, I came across TED Talks, and I loved the idea. And I had told myself that I will do one TED Talk, at least in a lifetime. There will be one. Right. At that time, I didn't know the idea, what the idea was. And then as I started to learn about it, I bought books and I read books about that and their styles and different people. I only realized the first thing that you have to do is to conceptualize an idea. My first TED Talk, it took me 2.5 years to conceptualize an idea. And because I'm into very niche areas, as you mentioned, gaming, social media, compassionate leadership, and then neurodiversity, more on the lines of autism and ADHD. So I started developing those ideas simultaneously. And then I started applying in 2016. Applications, a lot of rejections, a few shortlistings. And then I finally had my first breakthrough in Lahore. It was a TEDx event called London College Women University. And they shortlisted me and they invited me over to, and that was it. But before I started to become a TEDx, I realized that just speaking on a podium is not going to be enough for me. What will be enough is if I learn about it. And I enrolled myself in a program called Speak Up Challenge. And I used to finish at 8 o'clock, my work at 8 o'clock. I had to go to central London, do 3 hours of public speaking at least for 3-4 months. And I realized that public speaking is a science. It is a proper science. Like, you know, Tom, Dick and Harry can get up and get on the stage and make a difference. Yeah. All the orators and all the public speakers, they have gone through this process of doing that. And from then onwards, like in 2019, I had one. My second one is in 2020. I had two last year, 2000, about gaming as well as autism. And hopefully I'm going to have one this year as well. But that's going to be a big one.
That sounds amazing. So what I'm hearing is that since childhood, you had different areas of interest. You refuse to be put in a box, which is great. And there's a method to this madness, right? So there's
Absolutely. And I got it from my father because he was just like that. He expanded his, and he just narrowed his repertoire in then. And he concentrated on a few subjects. And that's what I did. I was learning so many things. I became engrossed in too many things. But then I pick it up, get interested in it for a few months. And then I knew this is not my thing. And then I would let go of it. Because it's very difficult to let go of things. People at my stage, they don't. They just accumulate. But I believe in having picking up a few things, concentrating on it, and making the best out of it. My father once said, he said that, I don't mind if you become a shepherd one day. But they say in Urdu, agar padhni sakte to bakriya charaoge. But if you want to be a shepherd, I want you to be the best shepherd around.
That's amazing advice. Yeah. No, absolutely. Like, whatever you do, just do the best at it. So I'm just going to narrow in on social media now. And so social media nowadays, Dr. Khurram, has not only changed the way people view the world, but how they view themselves as well, with everyone going online, sharing bits and pieces of their personal lives, professional lives. There are various and countless social media networking websites. And so now these likes, comments, views, engagement, they've sort of, rather than performance metrics, they've become metrics for validation and self-worth and self-esteem. And so in your experience, how has social media really impacted mental health?
Well, again, I'll start from the very start of social media. Social media was created to share, to share knowledge, to enhance interactions. And it did to a certain bit. Like, the first social media platform that was created by China was that was way back in 1999. And before that, we used to have MIRCs and MSNs. MSN chats, we used to go and we used to share our things. But then the models transformed, especially after Weibo, Facebook, Twitter. Everything changed after that. The whole world just turned around on its face. And initially, everybody thought that it's going to be of beneficial to us. Like, don't get me wrong, I'm not against these social media platforms.
Yeah.
It is because of this platform that we are here talking to each other.
Yes.
So I value this a lot, but the thing is, there has to be some kind of balance. I was reading on there's a professor called Mary Akin. She's a forensic cyber psychologist, and she has done a lot of research on this. And she was saying that if you are going on a journey, for example, let's say you're going to the northern areas of Pakistan, or if you are traveling to US, then you have your preparation. You give yourself preparation. You take the right clothes out. You do your itineraries. You book flight tickets. You know where you're going to land. You know where you're going to stay. Everything is known to you. When social media was introduced to us, we were not told about the vices it has and where it can lead us. So really, they gave us a tool and they said, okay, do whatever you want to do with it. And as human mind, we are Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. We have our darker side and we have our very positive sides. A lot of people, they went on to the darker side.
Yeah.
And as a result of that, we see these things about validation about social media. We call it FOMO, the fear of missing out. And again, if you look at the fear of missing out, it has got three components. It's got a biological component, it's got a social component, and it's got a psychological component. We have become nosy parkers, basically. Like it's the deprivatization of deep, I won't say privatization, it's deep privacy of our own privacy. It literally render us open right in front of everybody.
Yeah.
But the thing, what we do not see is that when people put on stuff or when people share the stuff, that's a snapshot of what they're doing.
Yeah.
It's a snapshot of what they have achieved. For example, I remember I was going to a conference in Dubai and I was putting on a picture about conferences. I was doing two conferences simultaneously in the same hotel. With a gap of 2 hours. So I was just running around. And for me, it was really exhilarating and exciting at the same time. So everybody said, oh, I wish I had a life. I wish I had your life. And he said, you don't know what it is about. You don't know the background of it. You don't know the struggles that I had to go through. You don't know the empty room that I come to when I'm done and there's nobody to talk to me about it.
Right.
And that sometimes gets the best of me.
Right.
So people see the highlights and people do not see, it's the tip of the iceberg that they see. They don't see anything else.
Yeah, so it's just it's a very surface level stuff. It's one
very angle. Surface. Exactly. They see somebody successful, but they don't know the price that they have paid for it or the struggles they have done for it. People see somebody smiling on a beach and they don't know what their mental state is like. Like the moment they have taken the selfie afterwards, they might be feeling very melancholic or they're depressed and they're putting a facade on.
Yeah.
And the likes, what I'm coming to is the likes, the share, the comments. Every time you get this vibration or this ping, all of a sudden you become happy and you have to look at phone or you have to check that phone. And it is because of a phenomenon called dopamine release. And dopamine is the feel-good substance. We all know that. And we have become dopamine junkies over a period of time. And again, the dopamine is the substance that is released when you're doing alcohol, when you're doing cocaine, when you're using any recreational substances. And it happens when you are gambling. It has happened when you're a workaholic. So there's a behavioral component and there's a substance-related component to it. Some people say that the amount of phone usage or the screen time that we employ in, it is like having an injection of heroin injected into you.
Yes, yes.
That is the kind of dopamine release that you get out of it.
I'm so glad that you mentioned all these points because it's such a good segue into my next question.
Yeah, yeah.
Because there have been a lot of researches and studies done on social media, even more so after the onset of the pandemic, on social media and its relationship to mental health. And so, you know, it says that social media plays on a reward system, right? So the idea of a potential reward is actually what keeps people coming back, whether it's in terms of fame, whether it's in terms of monetization, whether it's, again, the likes and the comments and that feeling of self-worth. So it capitalizes on FOMO, which you just mentioned, which is a fear of missing out. And that in and of itself, I think, creates feelings of angst and anxiety, which could ultimately lead to feelings of loneliness and depression. And so how do you see this going forward? How do you see this going forward? How is it affecting the generation, the younger generation of today?
Okay. Before I answer this question, I will give you a bit of evidence base about what it does. Like King's College London recently did a systematic review. And they noticed that in younger adults and in teenagers, every one in four, they have got depression, anxiety, sleep issues, and stress-related problems. One in four. So you're talking about 25% of the population.
Yep.
25% of the population, or 25% of the cohort that they examined, which is massive. Another study suggests that in the past 10 years, since the advent of social media, because it's not just the social media that is responsible. For example, the tech devices, they have kind of evolved over a period of time. Like I used to be the Nokia 3310 person, and where you would take 10 minutes to write a long text, and it has changed, it has transformed from there. Plus from those dial-up networks that used to do ting, 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 ting. So either you use the phone or you use the dial-up network.
Yep.
So you could not use both.
Yeah.
So from there, the Wi-Fi, 5Gs, the tech devices, and then the social media platform. It's a triad which has caused all of this. And again, saying that, it's I'm not an anti-social media person.
No, of course.
I've got my Insta account. I've got my LinkedIn, Facebook, you name it. And I'm thinking of going on to TikTok.
I tested that for
a very long time, exactly.
Yeah.
But recently, I'm seeing very good use of it.
Yeah.
So it's actually the use. It's the use, how you use those devices. We know that this is not going to go away. Our generation, or my generation, I have come from a time where I've seen transitions. Like my first gaming platform was a TV game with used to have two vertical sticks and a cursor moving between the two sticks, and we used to play that, and then followed by Atari, and then we saw the video VCRs, the CDs, the DVDs, the Blu-rays, and now like Blu-rays are obsolete. Like it's the online streaming, Netflix, Amazon, Apple, everybody is.
I mean, your generation has seen the evolution. Actually, has
evolution exactly step by step.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I was cleaning my study with my two nephews back in Pakistan a couple of years ago, and I came across a stack of videotapes, like the old dusty box, and they became very fascinated. So I said, "What is this, Mamu? What is this, Uncle?" Like,
yeah,
and I said, this is something that we used to watch videos on.
Yeah.
They looked at it and they started swiping it. And nothing happened. And then one of them, they put it into the air so that probably there's some noise or some voice coming into it. And then they looked at me and looked at the thing and threw it away. And the Mamu might be going crazy. So they have not seen the transition. But this is not a transition. Yeah. This is here to stay.
Yeah.
This virtual world that we're going to live in. But the thing is, we have to balance it out by some ways. We have to still live in reality. We still need to be grounded by it. We still should know that social interaction, I think pandemic should have taught this lesson to us. Although the Zooms and the Teams, they kind of hit the roof during that, like the way, and it was for the right reason. Like again, in my medicine, people who never used to attend my clinics, they start attending it on Zoom and Teams because they were so anxious about coming. So there's a very good advantage of it. At the same time, we have to look at the other side of it, that it can be really, really detrimental to a person's mental health. Detachment from all the reality, social interaction. And that's what happened in the pandemic. We were not able to meet people, meet our relatives, meet our friends. And imagine what happened to us.
Yeah.
We were literally people with depression, people with anxiety. It propagated to such an astronomical level during that phase. And we should realize that we humans are meant for social interactions.
Absolutely.
The world might change around us, But we should be grounded that social interaction is the basic thing that we should be doing, even if we are using these devices.
No, absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head. The thing is that, you know, ever since these articles, and there's a lot more awareness now about the impact of social media on mental health. And so people have started talking about the digital burnout and sort of taking a break from social media, you know, unwind, unplug. But then I think to myself, if I even talk about myself, 90% of the workforce is online. I work online. Mm-hmm. I deal with 3 different devices during the day. And a lot of my work, I am from the marketing background. So my work, I make my work through social media.
Yeah.
And so it's absolutely very easy to get distracted and not stay focused. But so my question is it possible, first of all, really to take a break? And how effective is it?
Okay. Now, before I go there, I think I missed something, which is very important. These social media platforms, they are free, but they aren't free as such.
Yeah. Like, amazing. No, that was very well
to
said.
Do you know what is the commodity there?
Yeah.
Us, we are the commodity.
Of course.
A thought process are making somebody a lot of money. So they need our time. And our time becomes their money, not our money.
Their data.
Exactly. The data, the concentration, the time. The more time you spend on a social media platforms, the more money the big industries are getting out of it. I will quote the CEO of Netflix. He went on record and said that his competition is not Amazon, it's not Apple, it's not YouTube. Can you guess what was he referring to?
No, I can't really.
Our sleep. He said, our sleep is the biggest competitor of Netflix. And I thought that was one of the most callous statements one can make.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
And we know that a lot of mental health issues emerge because of sleep issues.
Yeah. Yes, they're triggers for a lot of mental health illnesses. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So coming back to your question about taking time out. Now, the thing is with Zoom calls and Teams meeting and Google Meets, like it has become a wonderful place where you can, in the setting of your home, you can do anything, although it has its disadvantages as well. But imagine, before the pandemic, for me, for anybody else, there used to be 2 or 3 meetings scheduled for us. And because we had to go to different places, so I had to travel to go to another place. It would take time. I would meet people. I would interact. Then we had a meeting. We would have some food, sandwiches, cup of tea, something like that. Now it is not happening. You're sitting in the same place. So what they have done is they incorporate 6 meetings instead of 3. So you have got back-to-back meetings starting at 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock. You don't get any time to interact. You don't even get time to have your own food in your own house. Like some people are struggling to go to the loo.
Yeah.
Like for goodness sake, if you have time, it does not mean that you have to squeeze it in. This is not productivity. Basically, because productivity comes from when mind, brain starts thinking.
Right.
And you know, when is it that the brain grows the most? The neurogenesis of the brain takes place in what phase?
During sleep, right?
During sleep and during the time when you're not doing anything. When people say they are bored.
Bored. Yeah.
Actually, it is the best thing that is happening to you.
My kids say that to me all the time. Oh, I'm bored. They get easily bored. But I said, you know, it's good to be bored.
It's good to be bored. Yeah. Exactly. Because the brain is reflecting on the autobiographical narratives.
Yeah.
It is reflecting on those experiences. And it is creating more cells, brain cells, to connect with each other in different parts of it. So but the brain, the thing that we know about brain is either you use it or you lose it.
Right.
If you don't lose a certain part of the brain, it will become redundant. The synaptic connections will go away, will wear because you're not using it anymore. Mm-hmm. The brain is very intelligent that way in self-regulating its own self.
Mm-hmm.
So taking time out is important. How do you do that? I will give you some examples. Like we talk about Far East, and we do not agree with the certain policies, especially China, Taiwan, these areas. But that's where the most brilliant work has been taking place. Taiwan has got Cinderella laws. It means that if you go onto these platforms after this time, you are going to be fined. And it's not going to be China, it's going to be you. You're going to be fined. And plus, there can be implications for more punishment. China has done the same. South Korea has banned all the devices in public spaces. So in the restaurants, all those, it doesn't allow you. South Korea took 2 million of its teenagers on boot camp to help them get rid or overcome the social media addiction. So one third of those cases relapse. Like imagine like the responsibility that they're taking to help people to get out of that situation. So this situation can be helped. You can live in harmony. And one thing you have to remember, the social media, we talk about social media addiction, gaming addiction. It is a different kind of addiction. For example, if you're talking about alcohol, if you're talking about substances, that means that you need more of the same in order to get the same effect. That's the typical addiction that we know of. Whereas in social media, in gambling, in gaming, you need newness, novelty, and diversity. That addiction is called, I'm forgetting the name of it. It will come to me. It is a different kind of addiction. It will come to me. But the name of that is completely different. It is called arousal addiction. So it's called arousal addiction. So that depends on not how much you are doing one thing, how much you're switching from one thing to another to kind of nourish the brain with substances called dopamine.
All right. Thank you for the explanation. I think that from a physiological neural perspective, it makes a lot of sense. And, a lot of people view this. I mean, I don't want to be anti-social media. I'm not anti-social media, like you said, you yourself said. And so we're sort of discussing the pros and cons and of social media. And I wanted to actually shed light on some studies that I came across that view social media with a completely different lens. And these studies are based on measuring the behavior of mm-hmm. people on social media over mm-hmm. time to mm-hmm. develop tools for identifying depressive disorders based on mm-hmm. their findings. Mm-hmm. Do you think this approach is substantial? Will it lead to something?
I'm a bit skeptical about it. Now, the reason why I'm so skeptical is because the social media platform, it does not give you the whole picture.
Yeah.
It gives you the snapshots. And then those snapshots, a lot of them, they're kind of fabricated. They're facades. They're not actually what the person is going through. Yeah. I remember I was doing a TED talk about autism, and I met a lot of fellow colleagues in UK. And one of them was talking about editing your own self, and how she started was that one day I saw my friend writing something very disappointing on Facebook. I said, I have had enough and this. And she was like, I've met this person 2 hours ago. What has happened in those 2 hours? So I went running in, rushed in, just blasted through the room. And there she was watching a movie and enjoying herself. And I was like, what's going on? Said, what's going on? You have just put a caption on Facebook. I said, oh, I was getting bored, so I thought I'll get some attention.
Yeah.
So I'm very skeptical about these. Like, yes, you can create patterns as a result of that, as a result of analyzing that data. But what you do not understand is the circumstances, the triggers, what is happening around that person, the social situations. How can you develop a tool without understanding all of that and labeling it something?
Yeah,
I think it is not possible. I would be the first person objecting to it. I said, this is not possible. If you're trying AI to replace something, which is just human interactions, because what humans understand about each other, nobody else can.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's going to be a checklist. Like, and checklist, like I can talk to somebody, and based on the checklist, without taking the context in, I can label anybody psychotic, depressed, anxiety, because I'm not seeing the context of it. And I'm not interested in the context of it. So it's not just a snapshot. It's a longitudinal thing that we have to see about a person. And although they say that they look at the history, but again, it's not the history. It's the snapshot of that history. There's so many information pieces missing in there. How can you relate to each other when you do not know the circumstances, the personal situation, the triggers?
Right. Right. And just to wrap up, I know that you mentioned, you know, you gave these references of Taiwan and other countries who are at the state level helping out their populations in battling with this. But we also know that in the emerging sectors like digital health, there are a lot of resources and a lot of tools that are helping people gain access to more affordable mental health services. And a lot of people, they have actually benefited from social media in terms of support groups, in terms of awareness, and even making their livelihood through social media. So on an individual level, Dr. Khurram, how do you find that balance? How do you use social media for the good, just for on an individual basis, I'm asking?
And the thing is, that there's so much good you can do. You can do a lot of psychoeducation through it. You can actually make the people aware of what is going on through these organizations have created apps which helps in anxiety, how to overcome anxiety, developing coping mechanisms. For example, the VR technology, virtual reality technology devices that they're using for agoraphobia or post-traumatic stress disorder, in some cases for people who are autistic, because they're the level of social interaction and how they use, how to encourage them. So there is no contesting that some amazing work is taking place, but it's not actually social media, it's the technology, what we should not be forgetting. But nowadays, what I'm seeing a lot is on Instagram and on Facebook, lots of psychologists, they're coming in and they're sharing their two pence. But the problem is, if you look at the background, they have just qualified. And I'm not really sure whether they're giving the right advice or not. Because, again, it will be cruel to give a wrong kind of advice if you do not have the expertise, or if you have not come to a state, to a level in your career where you're confident in giving that advice, where you have actually seen it happening or implemented it. Just reading something and getting a degree does not give anybody the right to do that. So I'm very skeptical of these things. Like anybody can come in, they can call them psychologists, they can call them mind coaches, or so many different names, well-being mentors, those kind of things. But if you look into their history, they're very young, they have just qualified. Again, I see it more as from a fame point of view and developing their own services and monetizing it eventually, which is not very helpful. So one has to be very aware, if you're seeking some advice, you need to get into the background of the person, who the person is, what is their expertise, and then seek their advice. Otherwise, it becomes very hodgepodge and it becomes very dodgy. And we have recently, we had cases in Pakistan where it came to the surface. So don't want that. But again, on the other hand, technology wise, yes, we are moving into a digital realm, but at the same time, we should keep it hybrid. In all honesty, a hybrid means you see face to face and you see things remotely as well at the same time. And if you see at some point that the remote consultation is more complex, then you make it face to face. This is how it should be.
Right. No, I think great advice. And yes, everybody that is seeking help online, definitely do your vetting first. Make sure, you know, authenticate the source, make sure that the person at the opposite end is in fact there to help you and has that sort of background and expertise. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Khurram. I hope that we can do this again, and all the best for the future endeavors.
Thank you so very much, Maya.
And everyone who's tuning in, until next time, take care of yourselves. Bye-bye.